When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
What do you know about ancient Egypt? Probably more than you think, because we've been awash all our lives in some general understanding of the pyramids, the pharaohs, the sphinx, the gods and goddesses. We've seen the gold sarcophagi, the lapis lazuli jewelry, the exquisite bejeweled scarabs. And there's the inscrutable but mesmerizing hieroglyphs, and you might know about the Rosetta Stone that cracked their code. But after that, that's probably where things start to get foggy. They do for me. But even though I may not have a command of the facts, I do still feel a pull toward the mystery of the ancient Egyptians. It's the reason I might linger in certain sections of museums, just wondering what it might have been like, how they could have accomplished so many astounding feats like the pyramids, which I assure you were not built by aliens, no matter what YouTube might tell you. If you feel that pull too, you're in for a treat. On today's Saturday Matinee, we're featuring an episode from the History of Egypt podcast, The Rise of the First Pharaoh. Host and trained Egyptologist Dominic Perry tells the story of Egypt's first pharaoh, a semi-legendary figure who unified the disparate lands and established the Kingdom of Egypt as we know it. Dominic brings history and archaeology into conversation with myth and mystery to tell a great tale. I hope you enjoy. And while you're listening, search for and follow the History of Egypt podcast. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
Hello, fans of History Daily. My name is Dominic Perry, and I am the host of the History of Egypt podcast. The History of Egypt podcast is a story of the ancient Nile Valley, from the very beginning of the world and the creation by the great gods, to the death of Cleopatra VII and the coming of the Roman Empire. Lindsay and the fine folks at History Daily have generously allowed me to share an episode of the History of Egypt podcast with you. It explores the very beginning of the Egyptian kingdom, the rise of the first pharaohs, quote-unquote. In this episode, you'll get a sense of how ancient Egypt's origins appear to modern historians, and how the ancients themselves described it. The History of Egypt podcast takes a special focus on archaeology, ancient texts, and art to reconstruct the story of this culture in their own words. We describe the lives of kings and queens, the mighty pharaohs, but also the mysterious gods, and the ordinary people who made this civilization flourish for so many years. Once again, my thanks to Lindsay and History Daily for supporting the show. Come, let us visit the Nile Valley 5,000 years ago. A hot sun beat down on a green land. This was no desert, but a verdant marsh, teeming with life and sweltering in humidity. Narrow waterways passed by muddy banks, thickets of papyrus and lotus flowers. Wild animals like the hippopotamus and birds like the ibis made their way across a lush environment. This swampy expanse called the Nile Delta was a wild land, untamed, populated by hunters. It was a land in the midst of conflict. A tired, sweating man knelt in the dirt. His arms ached from battle, his brow was sweaty from the heat. He rested uncomfortably on the ground, while another man watched over him. Nearby, comrades also knelt in the soil. Their limbs were stained with blood. The sun shone down on a day of battle. These kneeling men were the losers. The prisoner sweated in his humiliation and fear. The ache of defeat was nothing to the knowledge of what was to come. If he looked around, he would see that future written on the face of his captors. For those in defeat, this was a dark day, but for another group, it was a scene of victory. Around the clearing, warriors had gathered to watch over their prisoners. They clutched their spears excitedly. These men wore no armor, only white cloth kilts. Their skin, a mix of red browns and deep blacks, was shiny with sweat. They were warriors of the most ancient sort, followers of a king, and they had come in conquest. The crowd of victorious warriors parted, and a tall, muscular man emerged. He was elegantly dressed in a sort of tunic clasped over the chest. An ornate belt was cinched at his waist, and from this belt the tail of a lion hung down. The man wore a short beard from his chin up his jawline. Atop his head he sported a tall white cap, shaped a bit like a bowling pin. This cap was a crown. The man was a king who had come to rule. The great king, victorious in battle, twisted his fingers into the hair of his kneeling prisoner. He pulled the hair around his fist and yanked the prisoner up onto his haunches. With his other arm, the king lifted a threatening weapon. It was a mace, a smooth stone lashed to a stick. The stone was carved with images of royal power, of great gods and ancestors. It was a weapon and a symbol. It was the king's power made manifest. The prisoner shivered. Perhaps, in a last moment of defiance, he looked up, staring the ruler in the eye. The king was a silhouette, haloed by the sun. His mace was a cruel shadow rising into the air. A falcon screeched, and the mace swished. Crack! The prisoner collapsed, dust kicking up around his lifeless body. The soldiers roared, cheering as their victory was cemented in blood. The king released his grip and raised his mace high. The heavy club, stuck with blood and bits, glimmered in the light. Warriors celebrated, prisoners were executed, and in the dust of a day's battle, the land of Egypt was born. Hello. Welcome to the History of Egypt podcast, Episode 1, The Two Lands. This is a tale of how Egypt, as we know it, came to be, of the legendary figures who built one of humanity's first civilizations on the banks of the Nile River more than 5,000 years ago. Thank you for joining me on this journey as we embark on a trip through the story of a fascinating and incredibly accomplished people. Stick around at the end of this episode, where I will introduce myself and the show as a whole. The story that I just told you was a lie. Or more charitably, it is a mythologized event in the early history of ancient Egypt. The tale of the king with his mace is one possible version of how the Egyptian kingdom came to be. It might be a version which the Egyptians themselves believed, but it is not quite the truth. The tale of the king executing his prisoners is a legendary origin for Egypt as a state. It's not the whole story, not by a long shot, but it is a good place to start. Why? Well, for one thing, it's a story which the Egyptians themselves commemorated. For another, it is a dramatic introduction to the world of the pharaohs as a whole. Welcome to ancient Egypt. If you go to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, one of the first artifacts you will see is a small grey palette. It is about 63 centimetres tall, 2 feet. It is made of stone, carved and polished smooth. It looks like an inverted triangle, and it is decorated on both sides with hieroglyphs and artistic scenes. The pictures on the palette focus on one thing in particular, a powerful man bearing the hallmarks of a king. This man is called Namer. Namer is a good candidate for being the first, quote-unquote, king of Egypt. He lived around 3000 BCE, and in his time, the people of the land seem to have been developing some of their oldest and most recognizable traditions. The Namer palette is a good entry point to all of this. The Namer palette is important because it seems to show one of Egypt's earliest kings in the act of conquering his enemies. The king appears in the middle of executing prisoners, the very scene with which I opened this episode. He stands tall, raising his mace, ready to smite the cowering captive beneath him. On the other side of the palette, Namer and his troops parade in front of a pile of corpses. They carry banners of the gods, and beneath them, a bull, a symbol of royalty, tramples and destroys villages. Basically, the overall picture is of a king triumphing over his foes. This is the first glimpse we have of the enigmatic figure called Namer. Namer lived somewhere around 3000 BCE, probably a bit earlier. His name means something like Na the Excellent, Excellent Fighter, or even Angry Catfish. Now that last one might seem strange, but it does make sense. Catfish are predatory, feeding on other fish and their eggs. Some catfish, including those in the Nile, even stun their prey with electric shocks. So the name Namer might convey the idea of a king as a victorious warrior. He stuns his enemies and takes what is theirs. It kind of works, right? Also, a name like Angry Catfish is just kind of cool, all things considered. Namer came from the south of Egypt, the region which we generally know as Upper Egypt because it is upriver along the Nile. He ruled an extensive kingdom, covering at least half of the country, and in his day, Egyptians were travelling and trading far and wide. Namer sent groups out into the desert to mine for gold and minerals, and he may have raided or warred with the southern land of Nubia, which is modern Sudan. Namer oversaw a prosperous and thriving kingdom, and he was able to send expeditions outside of his borders over huge distances. If you've read any book about ancient Egypt which was written more than 10 years ago, you may have an idea of the ancient world, and the Egyptians in particular, as being an isolated, insular people. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. We now know that the early Egyptians were a lot more international than you might expect. Artifacts of Egyptian manufacture and bearing the name of Namer himself show up as far away as southern Israel, the land that we call Canaan. That may not seem so far away, but when you're travelling by foot or by donkey, getting from Egypt to southern Israel is one difficult journey. So for these earliest peoples to project their power or their communications that far away is actually quite a big deal. What's more, the Egyptians didn't just visit Canaan, many of them actually settled there. Archaeological remains suggest that by the time of King Namer, Egyptians had already established trading posts or even fortresses in the lands of southern Israel. Essentially, they were there to trade, to communicate, and to live. As if that wasn't impressive enough, Egyptian archaeology even shows that these ancient peoples had connections with lands as far away as modern Afghanistan. Many sites in ancient Egypt from the earliest period show traces of a mineral called lapis lazuli. Lapis lazuli is a blue stone, and it is only available in the mountainous regions that we know as Afghanistan. Trade routes seem to have taken this mineral far and wide, and even 5,000 years ago, it was reaching the peoples of Egypt. So, we're not dealing with a world of isolated primitive communities. Instead, we have a new vision of long-reaching trade routes, communication, and interaction. A world that is interconnected, with routes and pathways crisscrossing the continent of Africa and the Middle East. That's the world in which the earliest Egyptians and their king Namer were moving. It's a much different picture than it used to be just a couple of decades ago. Namer did not rule alone. He had a queen, a woman named Neith-Hotep. This name, Neith-Hotep, means the goddess Neith is satisfied. Neith-Hotep was a very influential woman. When she died, she was buried in a huge tomb, even larger than that of Namer. Neith-Hotep's burial was a grand structure, discovered in the 1800s, but then, sadly, lost to erosion. This burial, whatever remains of it, hints that the queen was once an incredibly powerful woman. Namer and Neith-Hotep ruled a mighty and growing kingdom. There are traces of this time period all over Egypt. That famous palette, of course, is the most notable. There are also relics like the head of a stone mace, a mace which shows Namer seated on his throne while servants, warriors, and animals gather around him. Neith-Hotep is there too, sitting under a canopy and on some sort of carrying chair. Is this a record of their marriage? We're not sure, but it's a lovely little image which you can see, along with others from this episode, on the podcast website, EgyptianHistoryPodcast.com. Namer and Neith-Hotep, the first known king and queen of Egypt, ruled long, ruled well, and died at a good old age. They were buried in their tombs, and when they went to their rest, the next generation came to power. We will meet that generation in episode 2. This is the gist of Namer. He is a real figure, but a largely mythologized king, who lived about 5,000 years ago, and maybe, just maybe, was the first king of a unified Egyptian state. Namer the man lived around 3000 BCE. I use BCE rather than BC because that's the standard in modern academia. And Namer is a figure of intense academic debate. For more than 100 years, scholars have studied, theorized, restudied, and revised their interpretations of this man, and where he fits into the larger story of Egyptian society. For some people, Namer is still the first king. For others, he is maybe just one among many, a piece of a puzzle that is still missing far too many pieces. Realistically, we may never know the exact truth of the first kings. But that being said, new artifacts do show up regularly. The more that archaeologists dig in the most ancient cemeteries and settlements, the more they seem to find about this most distant period. Namer is a good figure to start with because he gives us a glimpse of how the royal state appeared or represented itself in the very earliest days of ancient Egypt. Now that we've got to grips with his life, we can look at how the rest of the country was forming and developing way, way back at the very dawn. Let's take a journey down the Nile, 5,000 years ago. Egypt, as a wise man once said, is a gift of the Nile. This is true, and it always has been. Without the River Nile, the land of Egypt and all its mighty accomplishments would never have happened. So to understand Egypt, we must first understand the Nile. The Nile is simple enough. It is a river, an enormous river, that flows through the northeastern corner of the African continent. It flows through 11 different countries, and every day, millions and millions of people depend on it to support their lives. There are two reasons why the Nile is so important to ancient Egypt. Apart from being a giant source of fresh water, the Nile has some wonderful characteristics which helped the earliest Egyptians to build a prosperous way of life. The first of these features was the flood. Every year, around July and August, monsoon rains in Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya fill the sources of the Nile with fresh rainwater. That water drains over the course of 7,000 kilometers downriver, which means that once a year, the level of the Nile rises heavily, and it floods in a grand expression of nature's power. When it does this, something happens to the land on either side. As the Nile rose and flooded its riverbanks, the water would deposit many tons of silt, mud, and alluvium onto the soil of Egypt. In effect, the flooding was like one massive fertilization, a huge dump of minerals and nutrients that replenished the soil and renewed the earth. Once the waters drained away and the flooding ended for the year, the soil of Egypt was revitalized, ready for farming once more. Covered in a layer of thick black mud, this soil could be used for crops and growing. The mud on the riverbanks was the lifeblood of ancient Egypt. They called this ribbon of rich muddy soil Kemet, the Black Land, and this is a name by which many people still know Egypt today. To either side of Kemet, there was Deshoret, the Red Land, aka the sandy wastelands of the Sahara. So Egypt was a place of two ecologies, the Black Kemet and the Red Deshoret. In between the two, the waters of the Nile were the primary source of life. The Egyptian word for the Nile is Iteru, the river. They didn't need to call it River Nile because to them it was the only river that mattered. In more theological contexts, the river might also be called Hapi, after the god who created it. Most of the time, in day-to-day texts, you'll find it called Iteru. So, Iteru the river, Deshoret the desert, and Kemet the black soil. These were the main components of Egypt's ecology, and from these elements, they would build a flourishing economy and a mighty state. Anyway, back to the Nile River. Once a year, the Nile flooded, helping to fertilize the soil and rejuvenate it. Thanks to this fertilization, farms could produce huge amounts of food without worrying that they would exhaust the soil every year. Of course, all that production needed to go somewhere, and this is where the Nile plays its second big part. The Nile River is quite calm, and it moves slowly. You can navigate it without much trouble, and getting upriver or downriver is as simple as hopping in a boat and breaking out the oars, or sails. There are a couple of places, particularly in the far south, where it gets a bit rocky, but mostly the Nile is a quiet, comfortable ride. This made it safe, and safety was perfect for ancient travel. In fact, ancient Egyptians never really needed roads or highways. If they wanted to get somewhere, the Nile was usually the quickest way. Putting these two things together, the annual flood and the easy transportation on the river, the early Egyptians were sitting on some prime real estate, possibly the best real estate in the world. They had everything they could need: a stable environment, a good source of water, easy transport, and productive farmland. From these building blocks, the people of Egypt would form a successful society and a mighty kingdom. They owed all of this to the waters of the Nile River. Egypt was a rural place. It was a land of simple farmsteads, tiny villages, and a few growing towns. The people were hardworking: farmers, fishers, craft workers, and hunters. They lived busy lives trying to feed themselves and their families. And in the most ancient days, their horizons were pretty narrow as the deserts that surrounded them. Way back in the earliest phases of recorded history, Egypt was a quiet and unassuming land. So this is the world of early Egypt and its people. On the banks of the Nile, they carved a humble but effective lifestyle. They farmed, fashioned, fought, and reproduced. Over time, their hamlets grew into communities. Communities grew into kingdoms. We opened this episode with a myth of the so-called unification of Egypt by King Namir. That myth is no longer popular among Egyptologists. So, what is the current theory about how the kingdom was created? Well, without getting too academic, there are entire books, hundreds of pages long, dedicated to just this process. The basic gist of the story goes like this. In the very earliest days, 3000 BCE and earlier, Egypt was home to hundreds of small, self-sufficient towns. These people lived tiny, local lives, and their horizons were limited. Over time, that changed. As generations passed, some communities began to grow larger, more resourceful than the others. Looking around them, the leaders of these communities saw other places filled with goods, goods that they wanted. With their warriors, these early chieftains began to raid. One town would attack another, taking its cattle, its grain, and maybe even its people as slaves. These attacks played out like a country-wide game, and one famous description compares it to a game of Monopoly. Basically, every time a town won, it gained some things that it needed and deprived other towns of what they needed. One by one, the strong grew stronger and the weak were forced to follow them. Communities became districts, districts became chiefdoms, finally, chiefdoms became kingdoms. Once kingdoms arose in the Nile Valley, the process of unification began to steamroll. Kingdoms started to fight with one another, and as one expanded, others were forced back. Eventually, it's possible that one kingdom in particular managed to overcome the others and establish itself as the sole ruling force over the entire land of Egypt. We're not sure exactly how this happened, or even exactly when, but the traces of archaeological material suggest that slowly one way of life and one means of expressing themselves began to dominate all the others. Eventually, Egyptians were basically living the same lifestyle all across the country. When this happened, the process of unification, as we call it, was essentially begun. Of course, it didn't happen overnight, and it actually may have taken centuries for the process to play out to its final completion. In fact, by the time of the Great Pyramid around 2500 BCE, the process might still have been in the works. Essentially, it's a long story, and we're going to get into that in great detail. Anyway, the basic gist is that cultural and economic trends slowly brought communities and peoples together, and over time, a mighty kingdom formed that ruled most of the country. How this all happened is still very murky. Some think that it was a process which the elites or the kings demanded and forced upon the people. Others think that maybe the cultural trends facilitated more political unity. Basically, the coming together into a single nation of people could have been a top-down process led by the state, or a bottom-up process led by the people. As of 2018, there is no consensus, but maybe we'll get there one day. 5,000 years ago, approximately, Egypt as we know it was born. Whether it was King Namer or someone else, or perhaps a series of people working over time, what is clear is that eventually the land slowly came together into what we know as a kingdom. The influence of people like Namer helped to direct many changes in the lives of ordinary Egyptians. With the rise of royalty and the creation of a kingdom, the history of Egypt begins. That is a story for the next episode.